Acquainted with the Night by Robert Frost. I have been one acquainted with the night. I've walked out in rain and back in rain. I've outwalked the furthest city light. I've looked down the saddest city lane. I've passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I've stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street. But not to call me back or say goodbye, and further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night. That was Acquainted with the Night by Robert Frost. Everybody knows that if there is a hole in a tree, there is an inside of the hole in the tree, and that sometimes something lives in that hole and will bite you if you put a hand into the inside of that hole in the tree. And the green grass grows all around, and the green grass grows all around. So the cautious among us are just going to keep our hands to ourselves and ignore that enticing void. But what fun is that? Writers were never known to be complacent. They're inveterate explorers, and mind's eye writers are much the same. Give them an orange and they won't just observe it. No, they will rip the hide off to see what's inside that orange, how it tastes, if it has a sound, what does the inside feel like. As Willie Loman said, you can't eat the orange and throw the peel away. A man is not a piece of fruit. Of course, we do this every day in the corporate world, but that's not the world of mind's eye writers. Today, they go about preserving both the fruit and the peel in the inside of things. Where do we start when we want to explore a notion we have? If we're Charles Darwin, and the notion is our observation that there's a lot of diversity and yet similarity among creatures, we board our boat and set out to find how people rationalize their notions about all this differentness. Paul Thompson sails along beside the great genius to try to discover the man's true heart.
Lately, I've been consciously trying to practice empathy. That is, imaginatively placing myself within the skin of others, breathing their breath, feeling their internal organs, thinking their thoughts, seeing the world through their eyes. The opposite of this, I suppose, is seeing the other person as an object, alien. Most of the world's major religions place a great deal of emphasis on empathy. Loving one's neighbor as oneself would be hard without empathy. But while empathy is easy when dealing with others like us, it's more difficult when we encounter people who look or act very differently from us. We come equipped by nature with a very finely tuned ability to notice even small things that may signal safety or danger. And this kicks in without conscious thought with those who are different and can interfere with feeling empathetic. I recently finished reading a book called Darwin's Noble Cause by Adrian Desmond and James Moore. I have read a number of books about Charles Darwin and his researches into evolution, but this is the first I've read that deals with the relationship between his research and the issue of slavery. For Darwin grew up in a family committed to the cause of outlawing slavery, as did his future wife, Emma Wedgwood, of the famous pottery-making family. His five-year voyage in the British survey ship Beagle, during which he encountered slavery in the Americas, confirmed him in his views that enslaving others was immoral. While Britain outlawed slavery in its colonies and managed to make the shipment of slaves illegal on the high seas, human bondage continued to flourish in Latin America and the U.S. South. The symbol of the anti-slavery cause was a drawing of a black African in manacles with the caption, am I not a man and a brother? Implying that humankind was one and that we are all children of God. But as Darwin began the researches into the origin of species that would lead to his fame, scientific apologists for slavery began claiming that far from being brothers under the skin, the races were separate species created by God in various regions of the world. Whites, so this theory went, were obviously superior in intellect and morals to the other species and were destined to rule them or enslave them or wipe them out. The growing acceptance of this view, even in Britain, horrified Darwin. He did not deny the claim that whites, especially the Anglo-Saxon peoples, were more advanced than the others they had encountered as they explored the globe. Whites might even be intellectually and morally superior, he conceded, although he thought peoples of other races in time might come up to the European standard. In short, he was a man of his society and his time. Few people in the mid-1800s realized the enormous time span of human development, and that the period of white dominance was only the blink of an eye in the course of history. Nor did they realize, or they rationalized away, the evidence that in earlier eras, other races had been equal in achievement or in advance of the white race. In spite of his own limited outlook, Darwin remained convinced that racial differences were superficial compared to human similarities. Humanity was one species, he argued. The various races were descended from a common ancestor, and regardless of whether whites might be more advanced, slavery was wrong. The debate raged between those who believed the races were different species, a view popular in the southern U.S., and those who argued for a common origin. Much of Darwin's research, including decades of studying the breeding of domestic animals like pigeons and dogs, was aimed at showing that selective breeding could produce great differences in animals having a common ancestor. But despite these differences, these varied types could interbreed and were one species. Darwin believed his research showed that human races, as well, probably descended from one stock. Genetic evidence and the fossil record have confirmed Darwin's hypothesis, showing that all of us are descended from a common ancestral species that arose in Africa. How the races came to differ, Darwin did not know. His favorite theory was sexual selection, people choosing mates with traits that appealed to them. To take a hypothetical example, if big ears were considered attractive, this would become a factor in choosing a mate, and thus big ears would become more prevalent. The whole issue of how racial differences arose is still a subject of research today. Darwin, obviously, was a person of great empathy, capable of fellow feeling with others of different races and cultures. He also saw deep similarities between people and so-called lower animals. He studied the expression of emotions in animals and how it resembled our own ways of showing our feelings. He gave up hunting, one of the great pleasures of his youth. This book has shown me that in addition to admiring Darwin the scientist, I can admire Darwin the humanitarian. The book also demonstrates that scientists are not coldly objective researchers, but people like us with personal beliefs that can influence their scientific research, for better or worse. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison poet Judith Zuckerman.
A clove of garlic. I take one clove from the bulbs, hanging braided together with other bulbs in the kitchen. A lone clove sits on my desk. Its skin, thin as rice paper, brittle, aged like an old one's skin. Its shadow is shaped like a blue tomato, an eggplant. I see Grandpa, rough, gnarled hands from sheet and metalwork, from working roofs. Grandpa's toolbox, the gray metal box, sits on the gray wooden Chicago porch outside the kitchen door. Grandpa and I are in the kitchen. Grandpa is making me breakfast. A big bowl of chopped eggplant that he broiled with a pepper in the flames of a gas burner on top of our stove. He chops it with another bush, a gentle chopping, no metal for this perfect eggplant. Oil, olive oil, a lemon freshly squeezed, and then, most important of all, he takes several cloves of garlic, one by one. Slowly, but with a sure hand, he peels the outer skin and mashes the garlic with a fork in the eggplant. Oh, it smells so good! Then he cuts cucumbers, tomatoes, onions, peppers, radishes, tiny as lemon seeds, and puts them around the eggplant in two big bowls, one for him and one for me. He grinds some black pepper in and pours in salt. Grandpa loves salt. He takes the big round black bread, pumpernickel, and cuts each of us a great big slab. Then he takes black olives, maslinas we call them, and puts a few around each of our bowls. Grandpa pours himself a great big glass of water. In my glass, he pours some milk. Grandpa and I sit down to breakfast together. A clove of garlic, thin skin. Peel away the skin to see what's inside. Grandpa, outside tough, yet inside the boy of three whose mama died, whose father remarried, whose young stepmother took only the baby of 6 months. Grandpa Sal, only three, and his brother Dave, just five, went to live with a grandmother until she died. Their family was so poor, there was no money for school. He was apprenticed at 10 to learn a trade. All he got for food was one cold bowl of mamaliga, cornmeal a day. But after years of doing what he had to, he also learned a trade. He wanted to get to America. He walked with other teenagers, singing to earn money on the way, walking from Chernivtsi to try to get to Paris, to other places, to a boat for America. Inside was always the little boy, still needing love, who gave love the only way he knew, by fixing food laced with garlic. I sit next to this clove of garlic, partly unpeeled, to see the clove inside, like Grandpa fixing breakfast with love, not said in words, like the tears now that sit at the edge of my eyelids and cannot fall. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Guy Thorvaldsen takes us on a magical mystery tour. An Ouroboros, the eternal serpent eating its own tail, the secret and mysterious chats with the inside of thinking about how we think we think. Have you got that?
Defining the brain is a slippery enterprise. Yes, we know what it looks like, thanks to the plethora of CSI shows. Busty forensic scientists lifting that gelatinous half-football shape, lump of gray worms from a poor victim's skull, examining it for clues. We also know when the brain dies, the rest of us turns from animal to vegetable. And we know the left side of the brain runs the business, while the right side of the brain runs the creative show. But then we get to the trickier subject, how the brain does what it does the most, think. Even trying to imagine how the brain thinks is a redundancy, a mental cul-de-sac, imagining thinking. While other organs appear to do things by rote, suck air in and out, clean alcohol-tainted blood, transfer urine, stand at attention when called to action, the brain creates thoughts, lots of them. But just try to describe what a thought is. Except for the balloon bubbles in graphic novels, we can't see thoughts. Thoughts are not really a sound, although sound carries thoughts. But just try seeing a word come out of someone's mouth, or imagine that string of letters entering your head. Thoughts tend more towards the ethereal, atmospheric, gaseous, perhaps celestial. Now ask yourself, where did that last thought come from? Yes, I know that brilliant scientists have conjured up chemical or psychological definitions of thoughts, but do they really know what a thought is? It's a guess, at best, like gazing up into the heavens and asking ourselves, what is the universe actually in? But perhaps the heavens is as good a metaphor as anything for opining about thinking. Imagining thoughts like stars randomly arising from within the deepening blackness of dusk. But here's the catch. Once night has fallen, the patterns of stars are mostly predictable. Night after night, the constellations tell the same story. Thinking is far less predictable. Try writing an essay. Throw it away. Then write the exact same essay again, word for word. Perhaps conjuring thoughts is more like a call and response, a whisper sent off into a pure, dark summer night, and the response, beyond answering what does 2 + 2 equal, is as arbitrary as trying to guess where and when any of the 6,000 fireflies in our backyard will decide to light up. But that's only the beginning. Once lit up, we are challenged to arrange those fireflies of thought into new thoughts and sentences and ideas. Then other times, it seems, the thinking process is more immediate. We eliminate the first step of calling forth ideas, and instead complete ideas race at us like a meteor shower, while we frantically dance around in our noggin trying to formulate them into logic, or a poem, or an essay about the brain. This brings up another aspect of thoughts, memories. They appear like birds or cars or elephants charging out of the mist, so much so that researchers sometimes develop drugs to stop them. But what is the price of controlling the linguistic affluence of our brains? The same, I imagine, as trying to control the universe. Then there are those blissful times when the fireflies of illumination flow more gently into our awareness, sweetly, like good sex, with a breathtaking sense of command and relevance, similar to the endomorphic rush of the long-distance runner when they've hit their stride. Elegant thoughts, arriving in beautifully structured light bulbs hovering over our heads. Yes, a lovely thought, we think, but still, to define it? My girlfriend says that meditation is a way to slow down this whole thinking thought process, to allow us to step aside and observe this cacophonic flow of ideas without responding to them with yet more thoughts. But of course, even quiet observation of thinking requires the brain to notice and locate things. Oh, there goes my laundry list of complaints about my boyfriend. And then we're suddenly thinking about our last boyfriend, or sex, or whether our current hairstyle is retro or postmodern. Soon we're yelling, stop, stop, right in the middle of our peaceful meditation. And the sensei whacks us on the shoulder with his bamboo cane and suggests maybe we aren't ready for enlightenment this time around. I know my thoughts on the brain are somewhat primitive, and that even as we contemplate this conundrum, billions of research dollars are being spent to discover what actually goes on in that twisted mass of linguinied veins and cartilage. Perhaps someday the secret will be revealed, the biochemical equation unraveled that computes how a thought or an idea or a word is formed. But even on that day, I will still have this question. If the thought comes from a bunch of biochemical reactions, just who kickstarts that thought into action? Who is running the show? In the end, thinking about what the brain does, thinking, reasoning, lusting, playing, interpreting, composing, is a thing trying to imagine itself, a practice not unlike something wise teachers and good friends tell us we'd all benefit from, seeing ourselves from outside ourselves, especially through the eyes of our beloved. They tell us if we could just do this, we'd be happy, or at least think we are. But those same teachers also would tell us the thing we seek is not a thing at all. And so if you think you recognize a thought on the road, kill it before you delude yourself that you truly know something. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
The final frontier, which defies exploration, used to be hidden. Modern science has lifted the tender skin and peered behind the curtain at our most intimate landscapes. Or so finds Guy Thorvaldsen.
Despite the slick technology, my black and white pre-op MRI looks ancient, more a water damage, Civil War daguerreotype than state-of-art marvel. To look real close might help Dr. Z decide which bones to cut and screw back together, but for me it's more interesting at a distance. My spinal cord a strand of white space, a Google Earth shot of an Alaskan glacier heading for the sea. Inching down the rounded peak of skull through the rocky crags of my vertebrae. Closer, it's a morgue shot, a murder victim beneath a sheet. Here we have a 59-year-old man. Given the constriction of the spinal cord, it's clear this poor soul was strangled. Closer yet, and faint gray striations appear on the granite facade of bone. These I know well, the rivulets of nerves, hidden tributaries of pain, seismic centers of my discontent, that have brought me to this stale room, painted in pasteurized fluorescence as if designed to blind, to say yes to a 7-inch scar from this overly cocky doctor, whose hands I now watch for terrible signs of tremor. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
And now a word from our sponsor, Digital Audio Dad. And now a word from our sponsor, DAD, Digital Audio Dad.
I can't get this baby to sleep. I've tried everything I know. I wish my dad were here.
Have you ever been in a difficult situation and just wanted a little fatherly advice? Well, Ron Cotell proudly announces the new Digital Audio Dad.
Oh, hey, wait. I've got my DAD right here.
This is your dad. Please state the crisis.
DAD, Jessica is driving me crazy. What's that bedtime story you used to tell me?
Don't panic, honey. Just hold me close to Jessica's ear. Once upon a time, there was an Easter egg named Fred who got lost in a shoe.
Yes, folks, a universe of advice and guidance at your fingertips, and a virtual shoulder to lean on when times get tough. All for the incredibly low price of just $19.99. Act now and get a DAD Advice for the Ages absolutely free. It contains such timeless classics as...
Son, you have to be the man of the family while I'm gone.
And... Young lady, I expect you to be home by 11 p.m. and not a minute later, or you'll be grounded for life! As you've heard, our amazing digital audio dad comes in a variety of styles and accents, each so realistic you'll swear you're talking to the real thing. This is your dad.
Oh, thank God, digital audio dad. I just got a flat and I'm stuck here in the middle of nowhere. What should I do?
What are you doing driving alone on a deserted highway? You know how dangerous that is. You aren't going to visit that rock musician, are you? You know I don't approve of him. Oi, how I hate that. That's Digital Audio Dad, available now in all fine electronics stores. Get yours today.
As Jim Nichols quickly realizes, the insides of things can pop their way to outside things, and then a fine kettle of peas we have.
Mystery. A pea is an inside thing, until you pop it from the pod, and the inside of the pea is the inside thing. But the cell membranes inside the pea's inside border the cellular inside thing, and the DNA string is inside that. The genomes are inside that, and complex carbon molecules have their inside thing inside that, and atoms inside that, and subatomic particles inside that, until finally, quarks inside that. They don't taste like peas. Oh, this is Jim Nichols, reading for Mind's Eye Radio.
Fran Rawl switches it up for us in Snoozy Tuesday.
Snoozy Tuesday. What's going on up here in my brain? Such thin tendrils coil and uncoil, octopus-like, reaching out from some unknown center for some unknown reason. I gaze around slackly, mystified by this thick veil, wading through layers of silence, touching no live wires. No emergency flashes fight this oozing napness. The energy is not there to switch gears, and I drift like flotsam and jetsam, catching briefly on awakeness. But I doze deeper and deeper, keep coming up for air, slower and slower, fronds of light slowly waving. Tiny Z's hover like sweat bees. And I'm down for the count without even being fertilized. This is Fran Rawl waking up for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison poet Donna Carnes.
Wild Thing is a story taken from a winter dream. It's about the many layers that make up a person, in this case, a woman, and a place. It is deep December, and I am inside a hill town. I'm wandering in a crowd of people dressed in dark clothing in a steep region of Europe, or perhaps in San Francisco. It's a dark afternoon. It's winter light. I'm with a quiet little blonde girl. She could be the daughter of a friend. She could be me when I was a young 4-year-old. She is small-boned and light, with white blonde curly hair, and has a very serious face. Like me, she is wearing fur and feathers, warmed by skins and eiderdown on this cold winter day. Like me, she is just, in the moment, unafraid and easy, although there is a feeling of disturbance drifting in the air. We are out and about and walking, shopping at the very busy outdoor market, in the crowd, near a great wall. The wall is to my left, to the east. The hills and rats warren of town streets are to the right, with pleasant but dark and small meandering pathways and alleys. The wall exists because there is a very large zoo full of wild things on the other side of it. And suddenly there is trouble. You can feel it blowing in on the airwaves. Some creature has escaped from the zoo, and people are running, scurrying away from the wall, hiding under barrels, moving quickly, tucking themselves away. There is such a bustle all around us, the little girl and the uneasy woman, as we stand quiet and still, taking it all in, the sudden mad scramble, the energy released from the unexpected unknown threat. There is a sense of danger amongst the pointy rooftops and church steeples. And yet, there's not a sense of horror. It is rather that a wild thing is on the loose, and we need to hide. So the little blonde girl and I, hand in hand at first, until I pick her up and carry her, we run, away from the wall, galloping west, up a sudden street, turning to the left, then down a steep cobblestone path, with the noise of a thundering animal right on our heels. As I make a sharp corner, I turn my head back to look, with a little blondie in my arms. She's not crying. She is watching, wide-eyed, the wild thing behind us. Suddenly I see it, the beast. It's a rhino, a huge black rhino of the sort the old zoo once kept. And as it makes way, charging directly at us, it also makes direct eye contact with me, locks into my head. We are the one it wants. So Blondie and I tightly corner into a dead-end alley. With the beast out of sight, but ever so near, we scurry under some old furniture. It is fine, honey-colored wood that hides us, an abandoned old piano, offering a nice protected little hideaway beneath it, with the piano bench and a few bars of wood from an old crate in front to shelter us. There we huddle, all pulled in, tucked away, safe in the moment, just out of sight, around that tight corner. Blondie curls up in my lap, and like me, with a serious face and not a single sound, watches that corner with a tense, focused calm. Then comes the beast, charging round the bend, the sound of its rear feet tearing up the cobblestones, sliding west as it sharply turns to the north, directly into our little cul-de-sac of a false shelter. I must say, it corners quite well for a Sherman tank of a wild thing. And there, at the entrance to the dead-end alley, it stops, its armored primeval body blocking our only exit, and it lumbers uphill, up the alley toward us, as we, ever so still, watch it move in. Our eyes are now totally riveted on the beast, even as we are trying terribly hard to not actually make eye contact. We curl up even tighter, smaller, pulling in all of our surrounding energy as we attempt to become invisible in scent, sight, and sound. Yet steadily and slowly, the beast moves directly toward us, as though we held a homing signal, calling it in. And suddenly it's there, standing directly above us, pausing. It breathes down on us, all around us, enveloping us with warm, wild rhino breath. We are now below the beast, surrounded by the beast, dominated by the beast, at the mercy of the beast, alone with the beast. Ever so slowly, the great black wild rhino lowers its massive horned head down toward us, up against the wall as we are. With no effort or sound whatsoever, it lifts the wooden piano out of the way, then moves its big rustic head down toward us, and gently rests it on the shoulder of the quiet blonde girl. And that is how this story ends, with the escaped black rhino, the little girl and big woman, in a simple Zen huddle, tucked away, hidden, in the middle of a hilly town, in the dark of December, inside a rather comforting little alley, safe in the moment from all the wild things that dwell inside of us. If there's any sound to be heard, it is only that of each wild creature breathing slowly in and out, although there might have been a lingering background note of faint piano. Winter's Amber is a poem about being inside the cold season, about how, from inside the snow globe of winter, we sometimes view the world as though we were caught in a piece of translucent amber and filter what we see through a milky fog which can blur the edge of what is real. In another sense, this poem is also about the color amber, which juts out into winter's white idea, like clusters of old prairie grass that linger on the February drift plain at Governor Nelson State Park and Holy Wisdom Monastery on the west side of Madison. Winter's Amber. Still lake, quiet sky, silent snow surround. Not so deep as far north, more like sea sleep, a flat waiting surface with undercurrent force. Nearby a drift plain, edged in halo hills. Is that a fog bank I see out there, or remnant wisp of winter wheat? Sometimes I forget the difference of sea and sky, earth and air, caught in winter's snow-cold sleep. This is Donna Carnes for A Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Sharon Van Sluis.
At the last Northeastern University where I taught poetry, I was hired to replace a rather conservative retiring established poet well regarded for his work in prosody. I was happy to get the job, as jobs for poets are few. However, within the first week of teaching, at least two of my new colleagues commented that they had expected me to dress more flamboyantly, more gypsy-like. I wore what I always wore to teach, the women's equivalent of Brooks Brothers suits. Apparently, it was generally expected that because many of my poems were not composed in strict metrical form, I would be a wild, free spirit who would wear gypsy skirts and comb her hair only slightly, or perhaps dress entirely in black and smoke thin cigars. No one asked me, though they may have wanted to, if I might also be an alcoholic, a heroin addict, a socialist, a manic depressive, or prone to suicidal thoughts. Those characteristics, too, people tend to stick to the idea of artist. Artists are sensitive souls, outsiders or rebels, or just weirdos who can't hold a job. That's the message from the outside. They are ideas that can imprison an artist, though most are able to ignore them and do their work. But the internal messages many artists give themselves can be a more constrictive prison, as they also contain a seed of truth. That is, that art requires constant sacrifice, and that a normal life may not be possible if one takes art seriously. And what seriously means, in the details, is that I may not have a secure career, may not marry or have a stable, loving relationship, may not have children or the whole host of other normal comforts to fall back on if things get difficult as I pursue my art. Serious means that I do my art believing that I actually have something crucial and universal, not simply personal, to say to the world, and that I also believe I have not only the talent, but the discipline and the will to draw up into consciousness and communicate clearly what others may only mutely sense to be true. The inner message of the artist, especially hard for those who find themselves blocked or sense they are failing, that inner requirement of the artist is the abandonment of what the great Greek writer Nikos Kazantzakis portrayed as the last temptation of Christ, the desire to live the normal life, to be a comfortable nobody, to live life just like everybody else. This poem is about an artist I knew who fell to the power of his own inner message about the cost of his failure. It begins with a rather pointed epigraph by Samuel Beckett. To be an artist is to fail as no other dare fail. That failure is his world, and to shrink from it, desertion. Arts and crafts, good housekeeping, living. Photo of you, David in background. It is black and white, Firenze, September. I'd ask you to pose in the careful light of the Accademia. No flash, I was so artistic. You in your constant black against the impossible whiteness and praxitilian lines. It is not grief that draws me back. You were so decisive, no one could call it tragedy, no sad and freakish slip of the mind. It was your alternate path, your secret black capsule, a plan B I had never guessed or seen. In time, I sorted the pieces and pieced it back, a keen eye for signs of gravest intention, the signs you made and followed, quick and sudden, out of your one and only life. On the left and out of focus, the museum guard, one dark arm and the leg of her folding chair. I recall she hooked you with a hostile stare. Her fierce eyes dogged you. I thought it odd, misplaced, a moody artist, innocuous you. But I see now she knew, trained to catch the twitch that betrays a mind set on violence. She tensed, ready for yet another failed, crazy man with a hammer, craving the perverse immortality to be earned in some monstrous unmaking. And you, with no dangling camera, no tattered map, no rapt look of awe in this hall of the noumena, she pegged you in partibus. She caught the faint whiff of it, some bad intention, and stiffly watched. You were no danger. It would be weeks later, and then alone, discreet, a rented room, an exercise in neatness. I saw nothing and blithely snapped this abstract pattern in black and white. How clear it is now, in that fixed moment, your body closed in, turning to stone, rigid against the sublime curve of the perfect ankle and the perfect calf, line of the David, giant, ideal and self-supporting, and here, ironic, the huge anagogical hand stopped in time, stopped in its inevitable motion towards glory, hand you had seen in 100 places, hand of the Sistine, hand of Adam, hand of the Maker, immortal above you. And here beneath it, your small face caught in paper and light, and the look you had worn from Bruges to Milano through 1,000 hard miles of merciless art. How clear it is now. The density of your sorrow and its direction, palpable and massive around you like the stone arch of a dark doorway. The ragged raven of your past and all your possible futures as failure shadowing you. Doppelganger, grim angel, incubus. It is small in my hand, my last photo of you. And it is not grief that brings me to say this. It is the days, my own slow and ordinary days, that continue incredibly on. It is my knowing now. If I could have known how you would weasel free of that sharp threat of long life as no one, I would take you, shake you hard, and in all ways I know, show you, tell you, it is this, this, and only this, the wild and physical house of your life, its necessary keeping, the art of it, the craft of it, the precious and terrible living of it. This is Sharon Vansluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison poet Ruth Nichols.
The House at the Farm, for Edward, who was. In the beginning, death moved in. He hardly noticed. The rooms it took he no longer needed. It was time. Time to spiral inward, to the center, the first house. Two rooms, a kitchen, and a bedroom tucked behind the chimney. Small to get closed in before winter. Close to keep fire through the night. Warm for the cradle, the nursing mother. Outside rooms had been tacked on as needed. Bedrooms for children, now gone. Mudroom for barn clothes, a sunroom, and last, that intimate place for cocktails, for two. For a long time, it seemed there was room enough for death in him. The kitchen was warm and fragrant, and he could head to the front porch to watch birds or split a little wood. He piled some for winter, not much. He still thought there would be time to do it later. But death caught up. Small cough, scalpel blade. Room by room grew silent. No lock could hold it out. When even the kitchen turned cold, darkness moved to his eyes. This was the wakeless moment that nightmares foreshadow. He learned how small this house really is. Now there is just this room, this small fire that someone tries to keep burning. But the wood is dwindling. He doesn't want more. The way is blocked. The door won't open. No one can come in. He speaks to the shadows. Let it go out. Nothing answers. Only darkness out there. And this little flame doesn't even matter. This is Ruth Nichols for Mind's Eye Radio.
Norma Gay Pruitt would just as soon stay out of the messy, dark insides of stuff, except that her need to know what mysteries lurk in the heart of man and woman and fictional characters trumps her desire to stay superficial.
So I am not very curious about what is inside things. Never one, like my husband and brother, who wanted to know how things worked to the extent that they had to make the inside outside. Both have literally taken perfectly functioning things apart just to see the inner workings. I even admire some people, like Steve Jobs, who insisted that the inside of his computers, down to a certain shade of blue, should be as pretty as the outside. I have heard tales of his tantruming when someone questioned this odd aesthetic, and we see where such meticulousness got him. I am just happy that things do work, not how. However, when it comes to people, even fictional people, as in characters, I'm a little more interested in what the outside covers up. That's why I study literature. It is a little annoying to not be able to really read a book without a pen in hand to question motives or talk to the author, the real inside authority on why what is happening is happening. But back to how people work on the inside. I made a quick search to see if insidious is related to inside in any way. Yep, but also nope. Insidious means to sit within. but they are a century apart in origin. So why did Walter White of Breaking Bad break so bad on that fabulous Shakespearean series? Were the seeds of evil already in the mild chemistry teacher just waiting to insidiously sprout when power and money added their fertilizer and light? The writers of that series were canny enough to give Walt a really insidious disease, lung cancer. A very medieval notion of humors might be at play here. Or conversely, will any person, given the right combination of outside pressures, in this case, the need to get enough money to keep his family after his death, crumble to evil? It is nearly the old nature-nurture argument, with nature playing the role of inside and nurture outside. We didn't settle it in college, and we probably won't now. Nobody wants to be an outsider, the sad kid that sits alone at the cafeteria table. We all want to be insiders, to be connected to fame especially. I had just this discussion about Bryan Cranston, the actor who played Walt White in the series. My friend is just starting to watch it, and I asked him and my other 100 Facebook friends why the man went without his pants so much. Why he wanted his inside clothes to show outside, making his undies ovaries. Wait, that doesn't sound right. But anyhow, before you know it, we were launched into the character he played on Malcolm in the Middle. My friend mentioned that he had met Bryan Cranston briefly, and then I remembered that my college roommate was a second cousin of the kid who played Malcolm. It gave me a little lift to think I was that close to stardom. I think this urge to be connected to the insides of things is what makes people do stupid and reckless things in order to get on TV, to be inside the box for even a few brief moments. Everyone wants to be doing the in thing, not to be out of it, resulting in some pretty silly adaptations in language and style by people my age, which is 60-ish. We say things are da bomb when da bomb has exploded and gone away years before. It's all good, and my bad are other examples. Nothing is less to be wished by youth than that their parents start copying it. It's like a letter jacket on a paunchy 70-year-old. And who cares about letter jackets anyhow? I admit my outsider status when it comes to such stuff. Another recent example of the perils of being inside is the recent polar vortex. Leave it to those weather insiders to come up with butt-puckering scary phenomena names. Anyhow, I hurt my back picking up a sheet of paper on the first day of the deep freeze, and while I don't have a real job and probably wouldn't have ventured forth at minus 11 degrees with 40 below wind chills if I had not been injured, I resented having to be inside my apartment for nearly 3 days. Just to assure myself that inside was the place for me, I stepped out on the porch a couple of times and had frozen nostril hairs to show for it. By the third day, though, I was a little nuts. I had read everything I wanted to read already and cleaned and done some desultory and not very good painting. Turns out that it matters how you feel inside when you do things outwardly. My husband and I had begun to verbally nip at each other by the time I finally bundled up and lit out for the street. I didn't get far, and my back was aching, but I was outside. And outside air, even in Chicago, is so much sweeter than inside air. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, Inside Your Radio, for Mind's Eye Radio.
So, have we managed to disclose the inside of things for you? Or at least the outsides? Or have we convinced you there's really no difference? And what's all this fuss anyhow, you may ask? As long as the weather's this cold and we keep the fur side inside, we're all better off inside and can save the outside for warmer times to come. That's our show. You just listened to The Inside of Things. Today's adventures included Donna Carnes, James Nichols, Ruth Nichols, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lewis Rawl, Paul Thompson, Guyther Voltzen, Greg Willard, and Judith Zuckerman. The show was written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. It was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Norma Gay Pruitt. Original music by Barbara Chusid. To listen to this and other Mind's Eye Radio shows, go to radioforall.net. Many of our programs are archived there. That's radioforall.net, and that's the number four. I'm your host, Greg Willard. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.